And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Joshua P. Warren, and your phone calls. We've got a few more ghost questions, then we'll get to your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Joshua P. Warren with us. We'll get to your phone calls as well here on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about hauntings and spirits. Why do these spirits seem to hang around, Joshua? Why don't they just move on to wherever they're supposed to go?
Well, you know, after 25 years of doing professional paranormal investigation, I finally come to the conclusion that some of the old cliches are absolutely true. These are beings that have some unfinished business that usually relates to the same old stuff. It's either jealousy over a loved one, or it's some type of material attraction to something like a property or an object or a treasure or money, or it is someone who needs some kind of redemption because this person is afraid of what might happen if he or she moves on. Because we have this sense that maybe when we die, suddenly we just get sucked down this big black tube and we emerge in the light, and everything's sort of sitting there automatically waiting for us. But it may not be that that's the case. It seems like there is some kind of a phase or a period there where you actually are able to make a choice whether or not you want to move on or not. And that's why you have so many people who don't move on, because they are afraid. I mean, it doesn't matter how rich you are, how famous you are, how successful you are. When you die alone. And after that, there is this moment where you apparently are there in the middle of some realm that we can't quite envision. And none of that stuff matters anymore. Your wealth doesn't really matter. How popular you were doesn't necessarily matter. What matters is the vibration that you have achieved, and the vibration that you're going to carry with you into your next incarnation. And so people who have done things that they believe are good things, that make them feel positive, that make them feel charitable, they actually raise their vibration into a state that makes them feel confident to move forward. But people who were petty, people who were selfish, people who were distorted in their prioritization, they end up creating a vibration that is much, much more dense, and it just feels sickening to them, and it scares them so badly that they just don't want to move on until they feel confident that they're going to have a better experience, and they're probably going to have if they take that lower vibration. And so that's why you end up with a lot of these ghosts that are actually people who have kind of a negative demeanor, because that's why they're sticking around. In other cases, it's people who just they cannot let something go that they need to let go, and eventually they will.
And Josh, what's the difference then between a ghost that hangs around, haunts maybe, and a spirit that visits a medium, for example?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of different paranormal investigators and psychics and metaphysicians over the centuries have really sort of struggled with the terminology that's used. And in my book, How to Hunt Ghosts, I tried to clean that up a little bit. But a lot of people think of a quote-unquote ghost as being that residual that I talked about in the first segment, being something that is just like a recording that is sort of replaying itself over and over and doesn't necessarily have the ability to interact. And then a lot of people think that a spirit is something completely different. The spirit is what we've been talking about when it comes to people like Gus Adler or especially O.C. Hamilton. This is still a living, interactive, conscious, unpredictable, vibrant thing, regardless of what realm it's in. And so it's easy for people to draw a distinction between, well, you know, the ghosts are the ones that are just like a big movie being played over and over, and the spirits are the ones that can travel around and can visit a medium and be channeled or can, you know, show up to deliver some type of a message. That's what, you know, people are often talking about when they make that distinction, but I feel like that the term ghost is a pretty broad general term that can capture both of those. In fact, I've always thought the best definition of a ghost that I could come up with is that a ghost is some paranormal aspect of the physical form and or mental presence that appears to exist apart from the original physical form. And so within the ghost, though, within the category of ghost, you can break it down into all these subcategories, which are basically based upon context and what we can presume by analyzing the behavior of said ghost.
Now, so what's an area that's more haunted? An area of tragedy, tragic deaths, or that somebody just dies there?
Well, yeah, whenever there's something tragic, that is when you seem to have more pronounced ghostly phenomena. And even though in that particular case, the phenomena may not actually be a living, interactive, unpredictable phenomenon, it still nonetheless may be more pronounced when it actually does occur. And that's because that when someone dies tragically, often there is this major surge, this big burst of bioenergy that seems to make an impression on that place at that time. It's very different from someone who sort of peacefully slips away in bed surrounded by loved ones, for example. And so it's almost like that when you have this big burst, this big violent burst of energy, that is what sort of creates what I think of as these artifacts within the environment. And, you know, in the past I've kind of compared this to maybe being like a passive RFID chip, that you have this information which is stored passively in the environment all around us, and most people don't ever even notice it. But once in a while, under certain circumstances, some of those bits of information will sort of awaken. Maybe a certain individual walks into that area and shines his or her consciousness upon it, and that allows these things to become active instead of passive, and this information starts being sent back to that individual. And that's why some people can see these things more easily than others. But essentially, anytime something that produces a large surge of bioenergy occurs, it seems to make that place more quote-unquote haunted.
Whenever we hear about haunted stories, Josh, we generally hear about it in terms of single entities, you know, by themselves. I very rarely hear about groups together, like, you know, six ghosts get together and say, let's get this place. That doesn't happen very often. How come?
Well, we have this great initial challenge of determining how to interpret the activity. And, you know, that's one of the things that we often overlook. You see all these paranormal investigators who are out there in the field, they're on TV, and you see them with all their equipment, and they're out there taking some kind of a measurement, and they're telling you they're finding something anomalous. But the thing that actually starts the conversation that gets them in the field to begin with is a report or reports that people have had in their own experiences. You know, everything starts with somebody saying, whoa, something weird happened to me. And so it begins with that human interpretation, and then you go and you talk to the person, and you say, well, what have you seen? What have you felt? And then from there, we try to, you know, document it best we can with our really primitive tools in many cases. And so what you have in the beginning is just a bunch of sort of random, spontaneous events that are taking place, and it's very easy for one individual to interpret the actions of four or five different ghosts as all being the same thing. because the original person having the experience doesn't know the difference, doesn't have any sort of way of discerning that. And that's why I often find if you go to a place like, for example, say the Grove Park Inn here in Asheville, which is a really nice, big, beautiful, historic hotel, that's where the president stays when he comes into town. At Grove Park, they have a famous ghost called the Pink Lady, and she is the ghost of a young woman who was found lying dead below a balcony in the early 1920s. Nobody knows exactly what happened to her, but since then, people have seen this ghost floating around wearing this long, flowing pink gown. And I was the first person who was hired to go there and investigate this, which ended up being one of the key stories in my book, Haunted Asheville. And what I discovered is that there are lots of other ghosts at the Grove Park Inn, but nobody talks about them. Everybody wants to talk about the beautiful young woman wearing the long, flowing pink gown, because that is a much more memorable, significant image. And so what you end up with are many of these different reports that come from thousands of guests passing through this place for over 100 years, all being sort of grouped into that one file, oh, the Pink Lady file. So if somebody has an experience, oh, that I had a Pink Lady experience, they say, because that's what they automatically are attaching their experience to.
Josh, you're like a funeral home. If people didn't die, what would you be doing?
Well, you know, when it comes to this idea of a funeral home, my wife and I lived for, I'm going to say something like 5 years in this old, creepy old house way out in the countryside in North Carolina. And we just had some of the weirdest, spookiest things happen to us in that house. And I'm sure I've talked about many of them from time to time on Coast to Coast AM over the years. And we moved out of that house. We moved on with our lives. And last year, we were in a restaurant, and this guy came up to us, and it turns out that he was the son of the landlord who owned that house.
Wow.
And he said to me and my wife, he said, "Do you guys know about the history of the house you used to live in?" I said, "No." We knew there was a church right next door. And he said, "That house is where for generations they would hold the wakes." And he said, "There have probably been 500 dead bodies put on display in that living room." And his father had a huge stack of Polaroid pictures of all of these dead bodies that had been in that living room. And for all those years we lived there, had no idea about that we were basically living in a funeral home, but it was certainly the most haunted house we ever lived in. And so that made me feel confident that, hey, funeral homes and places like that, they really are haunted for one reason or another.
All right, let's go to the phones for the rest of this program now with Joshua P. Warren. We'll go to Jones in Tacoma, Washington, first-time caller. Hi, Jones.
Hello. Hi, George. Hi, Mr. Warren.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call. So, Mr. Warren, I do have a question. For as long as I can remember, especially also along with my mom and I we've been in haunted houses ever since I was like 3 years old. And it's ranged everything from nightmares to actually seeing the apparitions and mirrors and stuff like that. And my question is actually for the last house that I actually lived in, there was a spirit there. And at first there wasn't really any real interaction, but we started having dreams. And at first it was kind of jumbled up, kind of gibberish. It didn't make sense to me until we ended up talking to this lady that actually used to be his caretaker, and it actually started bringing some stuff up. So for dreams that are kind of like that, how do you pick out what is clues and what just your mind is making up to fill in the gaps?
Well, Jones, that is an excellent question, and it's a very challenging one, because you're absolutely right in implying that there is this openness that you have when you're sleeping and you're dreaming to these other beings, these other intelligences. And, of course, I'm an extremely vivid dreamer. I have been my entire life. I mean, I always dream. As soon as, I mean, sometimes I feel like I start dreaming for a moment before I'm even fully asleep.
That's good, though.
And, it kind of drives me nuts, though, because sometimes I don't feel like I'm having restful sleep because I'm always on some big adventure, you know, constantly. I can't get away from it. But when you sleep, by all accounts, and we're talking about what we can see both using physics and what we have learned from metaphysicians, when you sleep, this part of the body that we call the spirit literally does separate from the physical body. And one of the reasons that happens is so that all of the resources within the body can go toward healing the body. Dreaming while sleeping is a very therapeutic and wonderful thing. I mean, it's amazing how much healing, like literally of yourselves, takes place while you're sleeping. And a part of that is because the energy is not having to go directly into the consciousness and the spiritual part as much. So when your spirit separates from your body, this makes your spirit much more open to all of these things that are sort of hovering around, so to speak, that want to communicate with you and contact you. But at the same time, as you also said, Jones, you are manufacturing things and interpreting things based upon your own experience. And so what you end up with is this sort of jumble of things that are happening that are outside input and things that are coming from within your own mind. And that's why usually when you wake up, you can sort of take some of the things that you dreamed about and you can trace them back to their origin. You can be like, okay, I know I dreamed about snakes, but I was watching a documentary about snakes last night on the Discovery Channel. So you're like, I know where that part probably came from.
Sure.
But then there's this other part that you analyze and you just cannot see any possible way that connected with any experience that you had. For other people who are vivid dreamers like myself, I mean, there are times where you know that you have entered entire worlds that are full of such visions, such music, such histories, that you were just not capable of inventing that. And so the best you can do in those cases to discern between the two is, number one, take a piece of paper and sit down and write all the things that you can trace back to a normal experience, and then write all the things that you can't. And look at that column of things that are outside what you think you have generated on your own. And then look for confirmation throughout your day that those things were giving you some kind of information. I, for example, sometimes will dream about a scenario that won't make any sense to me. And then later that scenario will actually play out in my real life. And I will know that I have seen something occur in the future. And so it's a very complicated subject because the dream state is a great mystery. But once you start sorting out the things that you can source back to your experience versus those that you cannot, it makes it a lot easier for you to start looking for external confirmation of those things that are outside of your own explanations.
Josh, give out your website, if you would, and a couple of your book titles.
Yeah, thank you very much. My website is joshuapwarren.com. I mentioned earlier, this winter, for the first and only time ever, I'm teaching some online classes in paranormal investigation. We're digging deep into ghosts, spirits, angels, demons, aliens, UFOs, magic, ESP, cryptids. If anybody listening wants to sign up, you'll get a big discount right now. It's live, interactive with me. Go to joshuapwarren.com to sign up and enroll. And as far as books, you know, I think a good one to toss out there for tonight's conversation is How to Hunt Ghosts.
I love it, Josh. I love it. We're going to come back and take final calls next. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, in addition to our Friday night into Saturday morning open lines, I'm going to be talking with a guy whose job is to extract venom from snakes. He's been bitten 26 times by poisonous snakes already. But he'll be our guest tomorrow on Coast to Coast AM. Gives me the willies, doesn't it? Welcome back to Coast, Joshua P. Warren with us. Josh, how long have you been involved in the paranormal research?
Right now it's been about 25 years since I got serious about this and started publishing started writing articles for the local newspaper, the Asheville Citizen Times. I mean, I was just a teenager back in those days, and even before I could drive, my mom and dad would run me around so I could do research to write these articles and publish them. And it's been just amazing to see, since I began all this, how much just the technology alone has changed. And, you know, back when I was first starting out, you would understand it if somebody saw something paranormal and didn't capture it on film, so to speak, or, you know, didn't get a picture of it. But now there are cameras everywhere. Everybody's got a camera right there in his or her pocket. And so the great news is we have tons of pictures of this stuff. But now it's getting hard to tell what's real and what's fake. And man, I mean, I used to be really, really good at doing photo analysis. And
it's tough now.
My team and I are still some of the best out there, but it's getting harder every day.
Anybody in your family interested in this too, or was it just you?
My family has always been, especially on my mother's side, intrigued with the idea of sort of ESP and prophecy. You know, it's funny because my family on both sides have been here in Western North Carolina since at least the late 1700s.
Wow.
And so there were lots of, you know, mountain tales and folklore passed down. And some of these, you know, these old pioneers, I mean, they were just, they were winging it. I mean, they were living on instinct and intuition and superstition, and they didn't know what the heck was over the next mountain. So there was a lot of that sort of open-mindedness that was passed along to me. But my mother in particular has, who's there, by the way, at the show that you did in Asheville, so is my sister.
That's
and
right.
They both
met them all.
Loved it. You got, as a matter of fact, I bet you met my mom, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I sure did.
My mom has always been such a wonderful supporter, and she has never been one of those people who has publicly come out and said, you know, I have some ability or I have some gift. But over and over and over, growing up, she would just do the most amazing, miraculous thing. She would predict things all the time, and they would come true, just like she said. It was very hard to get away with mischief as a kid. So I definitely think I have a gene there for being open to all of this.
How do you cleanse a house from a ghost? People said sage. What the heck does sage do?
Well, you know, when it comes to clearing a house of a ghost, there are really two different approaches. One is to try to affect the physical environment and change it in some way that alters the ability for the spirit to materialize. The other is to literally try to change that spirit's interest in being there. And sage, I think, kind of blurs the lines between the two. So what I mean by that is often if someone comes to me and says, look, I have this entity that is materializing, and it takes a lot of work to figure out sort of what we've been discussing on the program thus far, what this is. Is it a spirit of a person? Is it some kind of a disembodied entity from another realm or dimension? Is it something you'd think of as angelic or demonic? I mean, you got to go through that list of things. But regardless, at the end of the day, all these things have to take on some kind of a physical form that is able to interface with you in this physical world. And so the first thing you want to do is change the physical environment to make it more difficult for them to manifest or materialize. So I tell people, for one thing, try rearranging the mirrors in your house. Because, you know, mirrors have long been associated with all of these sort of mystical subjects.
Oh, sure. You love mirrors.
Yeah, well, I found that there's a reason. You know, mirrors are, you know, when you look at a mirror, what it's doing is it's reflecting light. And we know now that light is an electromagnetic substance, so to speak. It's an electromagnetic energy. And therefore, we see that these manifestations are somehow causing electromagnetic havoc. And so a mirror is really just reflecting the same kind of energy that often ends up being used in a manifestation. So by rearranging mirrors or by rearranging electrical appliances, that can stop activity. I always tell people, try running a humidifier. That can make a dramatic impact because the humidity in the air prevents some of these electrostatic charges from building up, and that can stop activity. If you put any kind of a crystalline structure around, salt or quartz crystals, those things can stop the activity because it alters, again, that electromagnetic environment. Burning anything like sage is also going to change the way that, at least temporarily, these things are able to appear or disappear. But then from there, you move over to the non-physical, which goes into this area of how do we, if the physical alone is all you're trying to stop, fine. But if you want this thing to be gone altogether, then you need to look at the motivation there. And so doing a blessing often has to do with identifying what this thing is, learning its true name, telling it to leave, and then reinforcing that with your own mental power or your own mental faith. Because ultimately, if these things are plaguing you on the mental plane, then you have to also fight them and resist them on the mental plane as well.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Chris in Ferguson, Missouri. Welcome to the show. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Warren, and hello, George Norrie.
Hey, Chris.
After all this time, I finally get to say hi to you.
Perfect.
I've been waiting for such a long time. So anyway, let's see. So I've been dealing with this dark entity for about a year and a half now. I lived in Maryland Heights, and there was all kinds of, like, the TV would come off and on, the ceiling fans would go off and on. One of the long-sleeve shirts stuck straight out of the closet. Nobody was anywhere near
Jeez.
It. And then it dropped. Yeah. So now that I came back over here into Ferguson, this stuff has never stopped. Things fly across the room, the doors slam. I saw a shadow head man in the basement down here. All kinds of things still go on. I found my dad deceased in this house about 3 years ago. And so anyway, what I've been doing is I set up some cameras in the house. And I do have this thing going under the covers and moving around. You can see it on film. I have about another 50 videos that I haven't even looked at yet. Now, one thing that I did was kind of funny is I went to Home Depot and I bought a horn blaster. Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
When you push the button on it, you can hear it for like 4 or 5 blocks.
Yes, you can.
So I had it in bed with me, and when I felt this thing coming at me, isn't that funny? I sounded it off. It was so loud, and that thing ran for its life. Okay, but I'll tell you, 2 days later, I found a claw. I still have the claw, and I think it might be part of that thing. Is it possible?
You found the physical claw?
Yes.
Wow. Josh, is that possible? Do these things manifest themselves physically?
Oh, yeah, and by the way, Chris, I would love to see your
that,
video.
That video.
Yeah.
How does he get it to you?
Chris, please go to joshuapwarren.com. There's no period after the P. If you go to joshuapwarren.com, you can scroll down there to find my email address, and I read every single email that I get. I do my best to respond. Please, establish contact, because I'd especially love to see this thing slipping under your covers, so to speak. When it comes to the claw, over and over again, I hear from people who tell me a similar story. They say, look, I have some kind of a being that's in my house. They see it. It's tossing objects around. It taps them from time to time, et cetera. And then one day they uncover some kind of a weird little object. And it could be a doll in some cases. I don't know the exact nature of the claw that you're talking about, but, obviously it was something odd enough for you to think it is significant. And this goes back to the idea that this could be the product of some kind of a magical ritual. There are times when a ghost just appears. And when I say ghost, I mean that very loosely, because what you're dealing with here, for all we know, may be some type of interdimensional being. It may even be something that people would think of as demonic. Who knows? But sometimes you have these ghosts that will just appear somewhere because that ghost has some attachment to that place. In other cases, you have individuals that intentionally try to summon these things and have them produce some bidding for them. As you probably know, I spend a good deal of my time in the Caribbean, and there is a lot of activity there dealing with magical practices, especially what some would call brujaria, which is or palomayombay, and this is based upon the idea that you can literally steal a corpse or the bones of a corpse and cram them down into what amounts to a cauldron and chain it up and then feed it with blood or tobacco or whatever else, and you can get the spirit to go out and do your bidding. And it's a serious enough thing. I mean, there may be people listening to that who just roll their eyes and say, "Oh, this sounds like something out of a cheesy, bad B horror movie." But no, there are people who take this so seriously. They go out, and I mean, there was one graveyard in Puerto Rico that was robbed of 40 bodies. 40 bodies. So there are people who take this very seriously. And what they will do is they will go through a ritual where they will try to summon some type of a being for some particular purpose, and then they have to sort of seal the deal. There has to come a moment when they establish sort of a covenant, if you will, between themselves and this being, and that is when a physical object is involved, and this object represents something about that relationship. In the case of the claw, obviously, doesn't sound very good. That's, you know, usually you think of a claw as something that would be used to harm someone. And so it may be that at some point in the past, somebody used this claw in order to form a bond with some kind of a dark entity. And if you want this activity to stop, for one thing, you go out and bury that claw properly in a place that is peaceful and wooded, or if you want, you can toss it into a body of water, a large body of water, like a lake or a river. That's fine as well. I would get rid of that thing, and that probably will end your activity. It's probably attached to that. But I like the idea of using the air horn there. I've never tried that.
That's weird.
But I'm going to have to give that a shot.
That is weird. And, of course, in the voodoo practice, don't they use claws?
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, I've been into some of these
chicken claws and stuff like that.
Yeah, I've been into some of these voodoo shops, and there are so many different types of animal parts there. I mean, depending on how extensive the shop's collection is, you can find almost every type of part of every animal in there, and they each represent something very specific to the culture that the practitioner identifies with, and how that person is interpreting the symbolism of that animal part. So that's why you have people who use them for both good purposes, like good luck, like the rabbit's foot and all that, as well as people who would use them for some type of a bad purpose. But I don't consider finding a claw on your property to be good luck at all, especially in context.
No, and they're ugly looking.
Experiences.
Here's my trivia question for you. I'm not going to give you the answer, though, because I want somebody to email it to me. But what TV show was a scene where the guy said, "It's not a claw, it's a quaw"? Would you know, Josh?
No, I don't.
I'm not. I'll tell you the next time I see you.
Okay.
All right. It's the name of the TV show. We're in this particular episode. He's arguing with the person, and he says, "It's not a claw, it's a quaw." And I just thought I'd bring that up, just to bring it up. Joe is on the Route 80 in Pennsylvania. First time caller, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good, Joe.
How you doing, Josh?
Hey, I'm doing great, Joe.
I just had a quick story to tell you. Back, I was probably like 13 or 14 years old. I was living in Flemington, New Jersey at the time. And my dad used to work nights. He used to get home around 5 o'clock in the morning. And he was grabbing something to eat. And he came out of the kitchen and into our living room. And here, there was an entity, I guess you would call it, standing in our living room. And he said he was about like 6'5", and he was in a brown robe. Well, here we found out that the previous owner died in the house. And I used to see like things walk past my my bedroom when I was playing video games. And like I would never think anything of it, but my mom had this big vase of flowers, and I used to see the back of the brown robe that he wore, and I would see the leaves shake on the tree. Well, here I met a friend of mine, and his mom actually found the body of the guy who used to live in my house.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, with his friend. Well, they never knew the story about like my dad and me, and they found. He was telling me how he found the guy in a brown robe laying in the middle of the living room, right where my dad seen him.
That's a great story.
Yeah, there was all kinds of weird stuff. Like my dad came same hallway. The guy was in my parents' room, and my sister came out, and he was right on my sister's heels, right into our bedroom. And yeah, I mean, I can go on and on. It was all.
I tell you, get out of that house, Joseph. Get out of that house years ago, to be sure. Josh, we only have a minute left, but strange episodes, huh?
Yeah, you know, and thank you for that call, Joe. And I'd love to know why this guy is running around in a brown robe, because that sounds like a spooky specter. But yeah, you know, it's funny, George, because the more you hear these stories, the more you realize that what we are dealing with here are little glimpses we get from time to time from different perspectives of all these weird things. And we are trying our best to put them all together without being able to see the dark spaces in between. But I think what we're doing ultimately is tapping into one big, large energy field, and that's what we're here to explore together. And so it's a delight to be able to come on and share this with all the listeners.
All right, my friend, keep in touch. Have yourself a great Christmas, Josh, if I don't talk with you before that. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.